Welcome to Simple Living Works, Milestone Episode 100. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, Bishop Guy Irwin. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. In this 500th year of the Reformation, I relish taking a look at some of its lesser-known yet intriguing aspects. In the previous episode, I talked with Chris Markert, the founder and Minister General of the Order of Lutheran Franciscans, and with Jeff Brown, a novice in the Order. In this episode, I speak to Guy Irwin, Bishop of the Southwest California Synod of the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Recently elected for a second term, Bishop Irwin is a Reformation history scholar and previously professor at California Lutheran College, Thousand Oaks. During 2016-17, he conducted Reformation road trips, giving lectures in each of the conferences in the Southwest California Synod, which includes over 100 ELCA congregations. We also talked about the contrast of the five-year radicalizing Reformation efforts and the recent Luther Conference in Germany, and about the uncolonizing Lutheranism movement. Here's Bishop Irwin, recently recorded. So, Bishop Irwin, what a pleasure to talk to you. I understand that you'll be speaking this fall about the relevance of the Reformation today, and maybe you could give us a sneak preview of what that relevance is.
It's a complicated issue, especially in the United States today, where there is fairly little historical awareness of the Reformation as an event of the past, or that this is the 500th anniversary. Of course, in Lutheran churches, we think about the Reformation every year, and so for us, it's not that surprising, but it is worth our lifting up in an environment where most of our neighbors don't know anything about it. In the world where I live, there's a lot of confusion between Martin Luther and Martin Luther King, for example, which is, it sounds funny on the surface, but in fact, it's not that surprising that Martin Luther just is not part of the discourse for the average American nowadays. So thinking about the Reformation in light of its meaning for us today means, for a lot of the time, simply explaining what it was. Most Protestants have some sense of the Reformation as a historical event, but they often don't know what it represented. Let me begin by reflecting a little bit on the significance of historic memory, because, you know, when we think back to historic events of such great significance as the Reformation, we need to be aware of what we're doing and why we're doing it. To choose October 31st, 1517, as the beginning date for the Reformation, for example, itself, was a kind of arbitrary decision. It wasn't until 100 years after that date that it becomes a kind of a milestone in Lutheran chronology, and in part because they wanted to find an appropriate time of the year to celebrate the Reformation, and it occurred to them that the posting of the 95 Theses might be that thing. Luther, in his own lifetime, never spoke about or wrote about the posting of the 95 Theses as an event. Obviously, the Theses were his work and were important to him, and he mailed them to Archbishop Albrecht of Mainz on October 31st. We have a letter with a date on it. But as far as the actual event of posting them on the church door in Wittenberg, that we only know about because of notes taken by one of Luther's friends, and we don't know whether he was getting the story from Luther or from someone else. So even the very fact of the timing of the observance is shrouded in some mystery. So when we think about what we're doing by claiming this moment as a 500th anniversary observance, I think we need to ask ourselves why it's important, what the Reformation meant, what it means for us going forward, what kind of meaning do we want to give this observance? One of the things that Lutherans have been trying to do this year in this organized memory is to avoid the word celebration for this observance, because there is much about the Reformation's history that is not a happy story. And, of course, the Reformation represents a break in the unity of Western Christianity. So there are aspects of it that are not really happy at all, even though we might be proud of its positive consequences. So even there, in the very observing itself, we're trying not to give offense to those for whom the Reformation has a very different meaning, especially the Roman Catholic tradition out of which we come and over and against which the Reformation developed, but also other Protestants who didn't stop with the Lutheran Reformation, but who carried the reform of the church much farther. I think that what Luther was trying to do in 1517, when he posted theses against the sale of indulgences, was trying to alert his contemporaries to an abuse in the practice of the church that he believed was quite fundamental to the church's purpose. And when I say that, I mean that for Luther and his contemporaries, the main activity of the church was helping Christians uncertain of their moral status to gain some assurance of God's love for them and the likelihood of their salvation. In a world in which life was short and uncertain, the church helped ordinary Christians understand where they stood before God. And it did that through a careful and complicated system of weighing and measuring sin and sinfulness and individual sins. And then the church focused its consoling work on helping people manage their sin. In one sense, by counteracting it through good works, and in another, by managing it through penance and essentially making up for sins already committed. So they had an instructive track that helped them learn how to be better, and they had a remediating track that helped them remove the guilt that went along with the sins already committed. It was a given for medieval Christians, as for Martin Luther and for much of the Christian tradition, that humans were in and of themselves and of their own power not able not to sin, that sin was part of being human, but that the church had ways to communicate grace to people in ways that made up for that, that in their eternal balance sheet, they could wipe out some of the debt that they owed, some of the sin that they had committed, and replace it instead with virtue, or, as the church liked to say, with the merits of Christ, which were so great that they were able to make up for all the sinfulness of all the humans who'd ever lived. And the church put itself forward as the administrator of this gift of Christ, this great treasury of merit, as it was called, and was able to apply it, at least in its own understanding, was able to apply this to the cases of individual sinners. This is what an indulgence is a promise of forgiveness for the punishment for sin given by the church in exchange for good work done by the sinner, which by Luther's time had become a contribution of money. So in a transaction, the believer would give money and in turn receive an assurance that the temporal punishment for their sinfulness had been relieved. By temporal punishment, I mean that they actually believed that there would be a physical manifestation of punishment for sin in the condition of the soul between death and heaven, that in between there would be a time of purgation called purgatory, in which the residual sin of one's lifetime would be removed in a painful way, be literally burned away. and that even though the soul was eventually going to be received into heaven, this this purgatory was a place to be dreaded. And by getting indulgences, by using the sacramental system to have one's sin removed, one could reduce the danger of having to spend a lot of time after death in this intermediate state. Keep in mind that this is not this. Everyone in purgatory was going to go to heaven eventually. It was just a matter of how much they'd managed to deal with their sin in their lifetime would determine how long they had to spend in this time of purgation. Much of this is still, in one way or another, still part of the Roman Catholic understanding of how grace does away with sin, although modern Roman Catholics have, of course, removed the abuse of indulgences for payment. They're now seen as part of God's reward for leading a virtuous life and engaging in devotional practices. But for Luther, this was a fraud, that the Church could make promises of a kind of forgiveness that it couldn't really guarantee, and do that through accepting money from its believers was, for Luther, an abuse and in a way, a fraud. And indeed, the popularity of indulgences dried up almost immediately in Germany when Luther started complaining about them, because there must have been some residual doubt in people's minds as to whether this was really an effective way to assure themselves of a reasonably pain-free passage to heaven. And in fact, when Luther started criticizing the sale of indulgences, this hit the Church, and in particular a couple of important bishops in Germany, in a financial sense, in that their funds dried up. And the Reformation, in a sense, is the back and forth between a Church that felt endangered and threatened by Luther's criticism of its practices, and Luther, on his side, who was increasingly emboldened by the Church's negative reactions to him, to come to believe that the whole Church system was corrupt and needed to be reformed from the top to the bottom. And this defiance of traditional authority, which cost Luther his membership in the Church, he was excommunicated, he was in a day in which church and state were not separate, he was also outlawed by the Holy Roman Emperor. He became a kind of a non-person. But his teachings and his ideas were popular enough and enough in line with the spirit of the times that he lived to, by the standards of the time, a ripe old age and died in his bed, which would not have been imagined for someone who challenged the Church as fundamentally as he had. So in a way, we see Luther as a kind of heroic figure, a single individual who stood up against a powerful institution, two powerful institutions, the most powerful anyone could imagine, and lived to tell about it. And in actual fact, was able to effect a deep and long-lasting change in the way Christianity was understood, one that persists unto today. So when we think about the Reformation today, we're remembering this dramatic historical turn of events, and we're reassessing, in a sense, what it means for us to be in that tradition today, especially those of us who live within it. Those who do not, like Roman Catholics, we're still affected by it, and the Reformation observance is an opportunity for both churches to think about the things that drove them apart and whether those are still church-dividing issues today.
Many of the Protestants followed John Calvin more than they did Martin Luther. How are they remembering the Reformation?
In some cases, they are beginning a multi-year remembrance of the Reformation this year. Obviously, what Luther did was definitive for them as well, even though Calvin came along later. And even in Luther's own lifetime, there were Swiss reformers who one could see as precursors to Calvin later. One of the interesting things about this, from my perspective, is that Protestants will have a lot of opportunities to observe 500th anniversaries in the years ahead. The Anglican tradition, for example, which is another breakaway from the Church of Rome, doesn't happen until the 1520s and 30s. And so the Church of England, if it had a starting date and a 500th anniversary to observe, it won't be doing so for some time. Calvin himself became prominent only in the 1530s and lived, of course, considerably longer than Luther. So there will be, I've been joking that for those of us who specialize in the Reformation, there will be 500th anniversaries galore for us to observe in the decades to come. It's just the Lutherans as sort of the first out of the block, as it were, with Luther's 1517 protest. We get to lead the parade in terms of this historical memory. I hope we do it right and we do it well enough that we can have some influence on the way this is looked at in the years ahead.
You attended a Luther conference in Germany just recently, and so there's a variety of ways that scholars are evaluating the Reformation. For the last 5 years, there's been a movement in Germany and internationally called Radicalizing Reformation. How would the conference you attended differ from the five-year, five-volume study of Radicalizing Reformation?
Yeah, there is quite a lot of difference, mostly in the method and the goals of the scholars involved. The meeting I attended is the International Congress for Luther Research and the people involved in it, and there is some overlap between it and the Radicalizing Reformation group. But the group that I was part of is mostly made up of church historians and systematic theologians who are looking at Luther in Luther's own context, for the most part. That is to say, we study Luther as a historical figure who lived within a framework of time and in whose own lifetime a remarkable set of dramatic things happened. We examine the sources and search out new sources. Believe it or not, even after 500 years, we still find new materials with which to analyze what happened in Luther's story, and even archaeological evidence that has rounded out our picture of Luther's life. But the Luther Congress mostly focuses on Luther and his thought within the framework, within the context of his own time and the time immediately following. So we see Luther as a figure of the past. We don't, for the most part, the members of the Luther Congress are not in the business of talking too much about what Luther means today and trying to bring to find themes that can be motivating or empowering for us as Christians in the modern era. We're interested in those things, but the emphasis of the Congress is not on that. The Radicalizing Reformation group does exactly that. Begins with our context, where we are today, and goes back to Luther to see whether it can mine out of Luther's way of approaching his world, whether that gives us fruitful ways to think about how we approach our world today and the questions that confront us. One of the big ones that's really come into focus in the United States is the idea of an eco-reformation, a kind of understanding of our part, the human part in the created order, our relationship to the earth on which we live and the environment in which our lives take place, and to look at that from a Reformation standpoint. What is it? What is our responsibility? What should be our stance toward the protection of the earth as part of God's creation? On the social side, what is our place in a modern, globalized, free market economic system? This is something that Luther would not have been able to imagine in his own time. And those who are church historians would mostly avoid any attempt to try to build a hypothetical in which Luther could be carried into the present. But the Radicalizing Reformation folks start from this present understanding and try to find what usefulness Luther has in helping us understand how we relate to the rest of our neighbors, those fellow humans who inhabit the earth with us, who are parts of our political and economic systems, and who's advantaged, who's disadvantaged by the way the world works. And how would Luther, for example, interpret the commandment to love God and neighbor in a way that makes sense in the modern world, in a globalized free market economy. For Luther, the neighbor was literally the person you could see next door, down the street, in your town, maybe in the villages around, or fellow subjects of the local prince. But Luther didn't have a broad conception of society that included the people in his country generally, or Europeans. And certainly Luther lived in a time in which the full expanse of the world and its peoples were unknown to most Europeans. Luther was generally aware of Columbus's voyages to the New World, but he wasn't very interested, and he didn't see this as being especially significant. His world was small. And so when he teaches us in the catechisms how to interpret the commandments as a way of loving our neighbor, he's thinking literally of the neighbors who we know. But in our more complicated world today, we have neighbors whose lives impact ours and vice versa, who we never see, who are part of a great system that that impinges on all our lives, but is not personal. And our economic choices, our political choices have impact around the world in a way that, as I say, Luther would never have been able to imagine. So to take our stance as Christians today within this more complicated world is a different kind of challenge than Luther faced. Although the scholars in the Radicalizing Reformation group have done a wonderful job of laying out ways in which we can use Luther in the modern understanding.
Now, there are other Reformation efforts going on of sorts within the Lutheran Church. For example, the decolonized movement. Can you speak to their efforts and if they are indeed helpful?
Yes, that's more complicated. I've been following that fairly closely. I have a number of friends who are engaged in it, and I have, and although I've not attended one of their conferences, I view it with great interest. It seems to me, in many ways, a healthy reflection on Lutheranism in the United States as a post-ethnic movement. And in many ways, decolonized Lutheranism is a uniquely American experience and a uniquely American perspective. Because the way Lutheranism came to the United States, to North America, was for the most part by immigration, by Northern Europeans who brought their faith with them and then organized it anew in the new land, in the new world. Obviously, their earliest waves were people who came to colonize, in the case of the Swedes in the Delaware Valley, but also to settle and to be part of the growing American colonies, especially the many Germans who came to the Middle Atlantic states and to some degree to the Southern colonies as well, to find a new home. Sometimes because of persecution by Roman Catholic rulers in Europe, and sometimes simply for economic reasons, to leave more crowded places in Europe and enjoy the greater availability of land in the New World. And so American Lutherans, at least in the first generations, organized themselves across along ethnic lines, along the language they spoke. No significant country, in fact, no country in the 16th century whose language was English was Lutheran. So every Lutheran who came to America as a migrant came from a country that didn't speak English and had to come to terms with being in American colonies of British organization. And so they organized themselves as ethnic enclaves. And with the succeeding waves of European migration to the United States in the 19th century and the early 20th century, people continued to arrive from Lutheran countries. The emphasis, the German population, of course, was extraordinarily large, although not all Germans were Protestants or Lutherans, a great number were. And then the Scandinavian migration, mostly in the 19th century, also brought great numbers of people who, when they got here, of course, could not worship in churches organized by Germans, but had to organize their own with their own native languages. And so the story of American Lutheranism has been the development and then gradually the assimilation of these ethnic populations. The church to which I belong, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, is the product of a century of mergers. Basically, since the 400th anniversary of the Reformation in 1917, when this merger movement got an extra impetus, Lutherans have been finding an American identity that is separate from their European origins and organizing themselves into a large American church. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which is the only other really large American Lutheran denomination besides the ELCA, has a similar pattern, although its attention to the unity of its community kept its ethnic identity a little stronger than in the ELCA and caused it to assimilate somewhat less. Now today it is completely an American church, but it still has a slightly more exclusive understanding of what unity means, which kept it from being part of the larger ELCA group of churches of very many different backgrounds who found their way together. Now, that being said, what does it mean then to be an American Lutheran, an English-speaking Lutheran today in the United States? That has often kept with it an underpinning of ethnicity, that people felt that they were Lutheran because their families were Lutheran, they'd always been Lutheran, even though the Lutheran Church has had African-American members for centuries, especially in the American South. African-Americans joined Lutheran churches early on, and there are many historically black Lutheran congregations in parts of the country. We also, even in Southern California, have a number of African-American Lutheran congregations. In spite of that, for the most part, Lutheranism in America has been a white phenomenon, and even today the ELCA is a very white church. And the decolonized movement is trying to find ways in which it can continue the process of removing the ethnic identity in Lutheranism in order to make it more genuinely welcoming to people who don't share the ethnic background. So in its understanding, and there's room for argument about tactics, but in the basic understanding of the decolonized movement, the ways in which modern American Lutheranism expresses a European ethnic identity, some of these are casual and cultural or even culinary, that these are ways in which the church is in some way declaring a kind of exclusivity that isn't truly welcoming, and that the church needs to be careful about that. I don't think anyone seriously believes that there should be no more bratwurst grill parties in October in Lutheran churches. But that when we lift those things up as being in any way identifying us as being Lutheran, when they become part of what it means to be Lutheran, they do exclude people for whom that isn't part of their cultural world. I live in Los Angeles, the most diverse community in the world, according to the Pew Research Research Institute, possibly the most diverse community in human history. And here, even Lutherans are pulled up into that great diversity. And when I go to a congregation, what's going to be served at the lunch afterwards is as likely to be Salvadoran pupusas as it is to be German bratwurst. And I have never experienced the infamous lutefisk anywhere in a church of my synod. I know that there are places where one can seek that particular Scandinavian delicacy out, but it has not crossed my path. And so I think in some ways these things are taking care of themselves as the memory of the old ethnicities fade. But decolonized Lutheranism would like that to happen even faster, so that the church can become more genuinely open to all kinds of people and not have as much ethnic baggage as part of what it presents to the world.
As a minister of Word and Service in the ELCA, I'm so glad that the ELCA, even though it contains the word evangelical, is not a classical conservative church as that word is defined politically, but is indeed one of the most progressive denominations in the United States. And there are probably now some 30 different flavors of Lutherans. Some of them are what we would call breakoff groups who are not happy that the ELCA is so open and so welcoming. I mean, we have a national bishop who is a woman. We welcome gays and lesbians to be pastors in our congregations. So it seems to me that the ELCA is always reforming.
Indeed. Indeed. I think that it's unfortunate that in the English-speaking world, evangelical has, for the most part, has a meaning that is not what Lutherans mean when they use it. In German, from which, of course, we get the inspiration to call ourselves evangelical, because in Germany, the Protestant churches are called evangelisch, that in the use of that word in Germany, it's clear that it only means Protestant. They have a whole different word for what we think of as evangelicals, which is people who tend to be biblically fundamentalist, who are very strongly outreach-oriented, and who also expect of believers a kind of personal narrative of conversion. Those are qualities of English language evangelicalism that are strong in the United States, but relatively unique to it as well, and to the places where the American Protestant movement has spread out into the world, and doesn't have anything to do with Luther's understanding of evangelical, which is rooted in the gospel. So we're loath to give that up because it is the name of Lutheran churches throughout the world. Evangelical Lutheran means something in Lutheranism around the world, and Americans wanted to connect to that tradition by using it in the name of the ELCA. It might not have been a wise move in some ways, because it does mean something so different here. But if we could move away from thinking of the ELCA as evangelical and thinking of it instead as evangelical Lutheran, keeping the two words joined together, that might be a help. It's just difficult to explain in a soundbite world a very complicated path that we took toward deciding who we were as a church. But like you, I'm glad that we are a progressive church. I'm glad that we're open to all kinds of people. I'm proud of the way in which we witness to the gospel and to God's love for all through our denomination. And I think that in the rich stew of American political and religious opinion, we have an important role to play. Even as those Lutherans who don't agree with us are free to establish smaller communities of their own. And in some ways, all of us look then to the Reformation as our inspiration for the kind of freedom that allows us to stake a claim on the gospel and organize our church life around it. So I think that's an appropriate way to end this conversation about the meaning of the 500th anniversary observance of the Reformation this year.
You've been listening to my conversation with Guy Irwin, Reformation history scholar and bishop of the Southwest California Synod, ELCA. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com, on our Facebook page, or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. Also, it really helps our visibility when you give Simple Living Works a 5-star review on iTunes. My colleague Lee Van Ham's new book has been released. Lee's the executive director of Jubilee One Earth Economics. Entitled From Egos to Eden, Our Heroic Journey to Keep Earth Livable, it is volume 2 of his trilogy called Eden for the 21st Century. I've read and reviewed it and highly recommend it. Lee and I talked about Volume 1, Blind by Progress, and Volume 2 on podcasts. The links to those episodes are given in the show notes. I urge you to subscribe to one of Simple Living Works' free publications. Our blog includes the Weekly Digest and the Weekly Nudge. Just send the word blog to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. I've begun a new series in the Weekly Nudge called Healthy Political Practices and Spiritual Disciplines. I hope this and my other recent short features add positively to the national conversation about social change and support the voluntary simplicity movement. Need a nudge? I've been producing today's Simpler Living Nudge for over a year and welcome you to subscribe for free. Receive it by email or Twitter. Just send me an email with the subject nudge at simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. I've received lots of interesting responses, which you can read on the simplelivingworks.org. Click on Recent Comments in window number 5 or see the link in the show notes. Time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, please, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of the podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episode you want with or without show notes. Subscription to this podcast and to our weekly blogs are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity. Choosing to live simpler lives is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive way of life. It is not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everybody's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, "Live simply that others may simply live," as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. And you may sense we put a strong emphasis on social justice. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the 5 life standards of living more with less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed those standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The 3 parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.